Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moskowain has the day off today. If we could peer into the future, say 10 years down the road, what will we see? How might the United States and the wider global community look and fare as the result of changes underway as we speak? Populations which are aging as fertility declines, the rapid development of robotic and computer technologies, the new middle classes which are emerging in Africa and Asia as the status of those in the U.S. and Europe declines. There's also global warming and, of course, the coronavirus pandemic. Mauro Guillen's projections are at times surprising, unsettling, and encouraging. Guillen is professor of international management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and author of 2030, How Today's Biggest Trends Will Collide and Reshape the Future of Everything. We take a look into the proverbial crystal ball this hour, backed up by rigorous academic analysis, and lines are open for calls and comments as well. If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. Send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mauro Guillen, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary.
So let's start with population. A friend and I were discussing major environmental challenges the other day, and it was her opinion that to be successful in meeting the challenges, we need to address the growing human population. So as of 2010, as you write in your book, we were up to 7 billion people. But Mauro, you're also projecting possibly an overall baby drought in 2030. Can you get into that for us?
Yes. So as you mentioned in your introduction, fertility is declining. And by the way, the pandemic only accelerates that, because when people lose their jobs or they see that there's too much uncertainty, they postpone having babies. And this is happening in the United States, it's happening in Europe, it's happening in China, but also in India or in sub-Saharan Africa. You see, when I was growing up, Indian families averaged 6 or 7 children. But today, they average 2.3, which is barely above replacement, right? Being replacement level being about 2 or 2.1. I never thought this would happen. So I agree that we need to take care of the environment. I agree that we need to watch population trends. But I don't think we're going to see billions upon billions of people on Earth, let's say 20 or 30 years down the road. And by 2030, we're going to see already a very, very sharp decline in fertility.
Let's take a close look at some particular areas of the world. So in Africa, there could be an increase in population, which you say might end up a significant humanitarian challenge, but at the same time, Africa's youth might translate into an enormous economic opportunity on the continent.
Exactly right. So it is true that between now and 2030, about 400 million babies will be born in Africa. But at the same time, Africa has overcome many of the problems of the past, meaning geopolitical turmoil in some of the biggest countries, and also their economies have been growing. Let's see what happens, of course, as a result of this pandemic. But the point is that the middle class in some of the largest cities in Africa is growing. It's already 10 to 15% of the population. So I think you struck the right tone when you asked the question, which is Africa is becoming very important. It's going to be the second largest region in the world, for better or worse. For better, because it's a big opportunity if we can feed those people, if we can offer them jobs and so on. For worse, because if we fail to do that as a global community, then we're going to have a big problem in our hands.
You also discuss, you kind of take a little side road and discuss the humble cassava, which is a root vegetable, which, as you say, might be key to turning a population boom into a real opportunity for many in Africa.
Yes, it's a crop that originates from Brazil and South America, and it was brought to Africa many years ago. And it has certain advantages in terms of when it is harvested. And about 35% of the African, sub-Saharan African population right now consumes cassava big time. So it's a very, very important part of the diet. And the thing is that the conditions in many parts of Africa are very good for growing this root vegetable. And it can become one of the key ways of, you know, providing enough food. And by the way, you can also make beer out of it. So beer is becoming increasingly popular throughout the continent. And instead of importing the grain that they need in order to produce the beer, they could produce it themselves, which would be great because then they would be creating jobs.
Back to the overall picture, the global picture, Mauro. What do changes in population mean for the disbursement of geopolitical power across the world over the next decade?
I think we've been underemphasizing the importance of demographics, of population trends. While demography is not destiny, it certainly places constraints on us, and it also creates opportunities. And what's going on is that Europe and East Asia, including China, Japan, South Korea, are declining demographically, so much more so than us, right? So here in the United States, let's not forget, we have been below replacement since Richard Nixon was president. So I don't know whether you remember that time, but that was a long time ago, right?
Yeah.
I was a teenager myself. And look, we have been below replacement since then. And in Europe and in East Asia, especially China and Japan, it's even worse. So I'm not saying that this is bad. I mean, one of the good things is that women now have careers, and I'm all for that. But it has have consequences that we have to deal with. And one of them is the geopolitical arrangement, a rearrangement of the world. So it has to do with population, and it has to do with how rich or how poor those people are. And that brings up the whole discussion about the middle class.
So I'd like to get to the middle class in just a moment, but you touched on population decline in the United States. So in 10 years, will grandparents outnumber grandchildren? And what does this mean for terms in care of the older population in the United States?
Well, look, let me give you two facts. One is that between 25 and 35% of the healthcare personnel in this country are foreign born. I'm talking about doctors, nurses, nursing aides. And let me give you another fact, which is that upwards of 90% of the people here in the United States who take care of the elderly in their homes, those who choose to remain in their homes, are immigrants. So we can, and unless we introduce robotics, and I know we're going to talk about that later,
yeah,
there's no way, right, of coping with this situation without having some kind of a population increase, especially people in their 20s, 30s, 40s. And I guess the only way is either we have babies now so that we have those people later on, 20 years down the road, or we bring in immigration, right? We open the doors to some reasonable amount of immigrants. So those are the challenges, right? And I think we need to be keenly aware of what's at stake here.
Well, that can go in a number of different ways, depending on what happens in November. I wasn't going to wade too deeply into political territory, but, you know, some certain things might shift depending on how elections go. No?
Oh, of course. But I think besides elections, it is undeniable that over the last few years, there's been a shift in public opinion here in the United States. And as you know, historically, if you take the long view, you know, 100 years, 150 years, we've been going in cycles in this country, 20-year, 30-year cycles, in terms of public opinion being more pro-immigration or more anti-immigration. And I think it's unfortunate for the future, right, thinking about the future, that right now we seem to be entering one of those cycles in which increasing numbers of Americans, regardless of what happens in the election,
yeah,
have you know, a lot of qualms. They are asking a lot of questions, very good questions, by the way, about immigration.
Okay. So back to the projected decline in the population. One more little note here. You say modern technology has reduced our appetite for sex. Explain that, please.
Yes. So by far, by the way, before I get into that, the biggest reason why we're having fewer babies is because now women have better opportunities at their disposal and they're pursuing careers. And again, I think that is great. But technology is also playing a role in the sense that it distracts us. So there's a famous experiment of the island of Zanzibar in Africa that they had a blackout for a month. And 9 months later, those who had diesel generators didn't see a change in fertility in the number of babies. But those who went without power for a month, there was a 20% increase in the number of babies. So surveys here in the United States also indicate that our younger people in their 20s, in their 30s, they're spending a lot of time on social media, video games, and all of that. And it seems to be the reason why, as you know, Americans on average are having less sex, right? And so that, again, contributes to this overall trend towards falling fertility rates.
And the pandemic isn't going to encourage a baby boom?
Not at all. I mean, we've seen in every crisis, especially if it involves unemployment and uncertainty about the future, that people postpone having babies. So what we do know is that families or couples in the end up having the number of babies that they wish to have, whether it's one or two or three. However, the mere postponement by a couple of years of having babies because of an acute economic crisis, such as the one that we're going through now, that also reduces population growth and contributes to population aging. So the mere postponement, even if people end up having the number of babies they wanted to have.
One of the trends, Mauro, you forecast in your book is that women will own more of the world's wealth than men by the year 2030, at 55% of the wealth. How did you come about this projection?
Yeah, so this is based on really good surveys that are conducted by financial companies such as Merrill Lynch. And of course, there's a number of assumptions that go into those calculations. But that's the number, right? If trends continue the way they are going, by the year 2030, we will have in the world as a whole more wealth, more net worth owned by women than by men. And by the way, there's one statistic that I want to offer to your listeners now, which I think will persuade them that this may happen, which is that right now, as we speak, according to the US government, the Bureau of the Census, about 40% of American households where there is a man and a woman, oftentimes spouses, but not always, the woman makes more money than the man in 40 and about 40% of American households. If trends continue by the year 2030, it may well be above 50%. And that's because, well, women are staying in high school, they graduate, they go to college, they pursue careers. And by the way, there's more women than men right now doing that, as you know, more college graduates. And although there is discrimination in pay, I'm not denying that. Of course there is, and there continues to be by gender. But still, this is a very powerful trend
And
that
a
women are.
positive trend, yeah.
And of course, a positive trend. I am, really happy about it. I have two daughters, so I have no problems about it at all. But I'm not saying that this is bad or good. All I'm saying is that we need to adjust to this new reality in which women are going to be more than half of the wealth holders and are going to be owning more than half of the wealth.
If they do own more than half of the wealth, does this necessarily mean there is more access to political power for women?
Yes, so far, that's a great question. So far, we have not seen a shift in terms of, for example, political donations by issue. But women do care more about healthcare and about education. They are more inclined to have more comprehensive insurance. As you know, experimental evidence and also surveys indicate that women tend to be more risk averse on average, okay? So what that means is that, yes, I think the economy is going to change as a result of this, and it may well be that political parties will have to pay more attention to them, not just because, as you know, they are voters, right? But or you are voters, but also because the women are going to become more active in terms of political donations.
Mauro Guillen is professor of international management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and author of the new book, 2030, How Today's Biggest Trends Will Collide and Reshape the Future of Everything. We're back in just a moment on Radio Times. We'll talk about how climate change might look in 2030, also the future of technology, AI, robotics, and more. Stay with us and join us, 888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In today for Marty, our guest is Mauro Guillen, professor of international management at the Wharton School. He is also author of the new book, 2030, How Today's Biggest Trends Will Collide and Reshape the Future of Everything. So we're taking a look at the world as it might well be 10 years down the road. If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. And one more question about women and wealth. We were talking about women and wealth and political power going into the break, Mauro. One more follow-up question before we get on to climate change. You ask a provocative question in your book. Does working increase women's mortality rate? get into that for us. Women traditionally, yes. You know, the trope is that women live longer than men. Might that be changing because of the stresses of work?
That is changing. And let me just give you the numbers. Again, back when Richard Nixon was president, women on average here in the United States lived about nearly 8 years longer than men on average. But that number has come down to five, from 8 to 5 last year. And the projection is that by the year 2030, it will only be 4.3. And you put your finger on precisely what the issue is. The issue is that as women have pursued careers as out of the household, but because of unequal gender allocation of tasks in the household, they continue to do most of the work at home, then they're under so much more stress. Now, they also smoke more tobacco and perhaps other things, and they drink more if they work outside of the household. And that's what's bringing down that. So women's life expectancy is increasing, but it's increasing at a lower pace than before. So women are falling behind men a little bit. But there's one group of women, by the way, white women in their 40s and their 50s, that are seeing their life expectancy actually go down over the last 20 years or so. But again, for the entire population of American women, life expectancy is increasing, but it's just not increasing as fast as before. So men are catching up.
Okay. In the introduction to your book, you write, the year is 2030. From Paris to Berlin, Western Europe is unusually warm with no end in sight to the summer's record temperatures, a fact the international press reports with increasing alarm. So Mauro, you're not seeing the brakes put on climate change anytime soon, or not enough braking to prevent real acceleration?
Well, not enough. We're not doing enough, unfortunately. And just listen to the news coming out of California.
Yeah.
But not just California, many other parts of the world. Indonesia last year decided that Jakarta, its capital city, more than 20 million people, is just too risky. Too many saltwater floods, right? Or flooding. And, you know, the U.S. will be affected, especially California, Florida. I fear the most for our agriculture. How is this going to disrupt our ability to produce the amounts of food that we need to produce? So no, not enough is being done by governments, by consumers, by all of us, and by companies. I think we need to do much more.
You get into linear thinking and lateral thinking. And if you could just give us a refresher on linear versus lateral, and then how we might use lateral thinking to tackle an issue like climate change.
Yeah, so linear thinking is all about, okay, so this thing here affects this other thing over there. So for example, if we have fewer babies today, we're gonna have more people above the age of 60 in the future, right? So that's linear thinking. That's relatively straightforward. It's important, but it's not enough. Lateral thinking is, for example, okay, so China for many years, most families only had one child. And as you know, there was a gender imbalance, 20% more boys, more boys than girls. Yes. And what happened as a result of that was that families felt that it was very competitive to find a wife for their boy. Right. And therefore, they saved a lot of money to make him more competitive in the marriage market in China. But China then, as a whole, saved too much money. So they exported that as well as all of those goods. And guess what? Most of those savings ended up here in the United States. So those savings then helped us indulge at the shopping mall or now online. So that's lateral thinking. Right. So I've just went all the way from, babies in China in the 70s, in the 80s to the shopping mall here in the United States. That's an example of lateral thinking, which I discuss in the book at length, because I think it has made a big difference in terms of our own economy here. And by the way, it's about to end because, as you know, they're removing the one child policy. And of course, the China-U.S. relationship is not going to be what it used to be.
Yeah. So you ask, who needs the Paris Climate Accords when you have 3D printing? Tell us how this lateral thinking applies to this.
Yeah, so this is, of course, a provocative statement, right? I think we need to do much more than just use 3D printers. But you see, the problem that we have is, in general, waste. We waste too many resources. But not only that, then we transport those things that we produce and we never consume them. And so one of the great ways or the best ways of partially addressing climate change is to reduce our waste. And I think there will be an opportunity for perhaps reducing 2, 3, 4% of our carbon emissions if we can deploy 3D printing technology more effectively. Because with 3D printing, you print things, you produce things the moment you need them, as opposed to producing them, you know, massively before you even need them, just in case you need them. So that's the promise of something like 3D printing, but it's only one instance among many. And of course, in that statement that you quoted from the book, I was trying to be provocative, right?
Sure. Like,
let's think outside of the box, because I do believe that we will not be able to address climate change effectively unless we think outside of the box.
You borrow from Ben Franklin when talking about the critical importance of water now and in the future. When the well is dry, we learn the worth of water. So in 2030, will the absence of sufficient water in certain areas of the world be at crisis levels?
Yeah, absolutely.
Fresh water.
And here's fresh water, exactly, drinking water. Here's the problem. The problem is that the distribution of the population in the world is very, very weird. Cities now account for 55% of the population of the world, and that's going to grow to 65%, two-thirds, by the year 2030. But you see, cities only occupy 1% of the land, okay? Only 1% of the land. And they account for 80% of the carbon emissions. And many of our cities are built in places where there's very little access to fresh water. So just think about that combination there. So in other words, there's no solution to the water problem, and there's no solution to climate change more broadly unless we address the issues with cities. Cities are growing very fast, and they are not, you know, they haven't been built in a way that is congruent with this environmental crisis that we're facing.
You ask, will cities be livable in 2030? Let's narrow focus. Do you think Philly will be livable in 2030?
Well, Philadelphia is not one of the cities, for example, in the United States or the world, that might be the most affected by climate change,
like
for
Miami,
example, in the form of, exactly, of rising sea levels. And by the way, the worst will happen in South Asia and Southeast Asia. And I mentioned earlier the example of Jakarta in Indonesia, right? That's where most of the early impact within the next 20 years or so is going to be felt. So, yeah, I mean, Philadelphia is not one of the largest cities in the world, as you know, but it is a large city. Fortunately, it is a big city in terms of, you know, square mileage, right? And so it's a city where we can actually experiment with many things that we haven't tried out yet, which is what I also propose in the book, urban agriculture. I think we should have more of the food that we consume in the cities produced in the cities. In Africa, they produce 30% of the food consumed in cities within the city boundaries. It's a great thing. We should go back to the Liberty Gardens. You remember that from World War II when people were growing tomatoes because there was an emergency?
I've read about it.
Exactly, those Liberty Gardens. They were very, very common here in Philadelphia during the war years. Well, I think we need to go back to that because it is an emergency as well. I mean, an emergency in the sense that unless we act now, it's going to be really hard to reverse the trend later.
We have a question from Kurt who asks, how will rising ocean levels due to climate change affect life, as 65% of the populations, he says, are located near waterways? So day-to-day life in a city like Miami, is there a projection as to how that might look in 2030, Mauro?
Yes, and you can find on the internet many maps showing by the year 2030, by the year 2040, by the year 2050, what Miami and all of South Florida is going to look like. And if you remember, in his famous Oscar-winning documentary, former Vice President Al Gore, right, produced some of those images. That was already, you know, nearly two decades ago. But all of your listeners can find those maps with projections on the web. And they're sobering, right? Look, Miami is a wonderful city. It's a great experiment in terms of, you know, building a major metropolis, you know, out of thin air, really, because Miami was a backwater, right? A city kind of, you know, 50 years ago. And now is this amazing place, but it is under threat. There's no question about it.
Mauro Guillen is author of the new book, 2030, how today's biggest trends will collide and reshape the future of everything. And we're taking your comments, Radio Times at WHYY.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or feel free to call in if you like, 888-477-9499. Let's go to advances in technology, Mauro. You say we're going through the technological equivalent of the Cambrian explosion. Remind us as to what that was. It's been a while since we learned about that in school. I did anyway. But what's happening as far as technology is concerned? It is exploding, I guess, what you're saying?
Yes, so it's the same as several, many, many millions of years ago, the Cambrian explosion, when we saw more evolved multicellular, organisms emerge. So some of them really weird by today's standards, right? Mm-hmm. And within a very brief period of time, given, how old Earth is, there was a lot of change. And I think we're going through the equivalent of that when it comes to technology. I mean, it's not just robotics. It's not just artificial intelligence. You mentioned 3D printing earlier. Mm-hmm. It's also nanotechnologies coming up with new materials that will be more durable, more environmentally friendly, and on and on and on. There's so many things that are going on. The blockchain, right, that enables cryptocurrencies as well as many other things. And my hope is that instead of just using these things for the usual, purposes, that we also mobilize these technologies to make our lives better and also to deal with the environmental crisis. And one example we discussed earlier, which is 3D printing, but there's many others.
One of the biggest fears is that new technology will cost a lot of jobs, robotic arms and manufacturing, for instance. Is that a reality in 2030?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, this pandemic will only accelerate that. So I'm in touch with a lot of managers at companies here and around the world. And invariably, they're telling me that in the age of social distancing, while we still have to, follow those directions to avoid contagion, the incentives for companies to automate things, especially interactions with the customer, are really, really huge, right? Jobs will be destroyed. And other jobs will be created. What I'm hoping is that we will not make the same mistake that we made 20 years ago, 10 years ago, which is to forget about those people who are being displaced by technology. Talking about politics, I don't think we can understand what has happened in not just the United States, but in many other countries in elections recently without taking into consideration all of those people, especially people in their 50s that have been displaced by technological change. And of course, they find it very hard to learn a new occupation, right, a new job. So that's the challenge. And of course, in that context, Mary, that's when we, I think, need to start having a good conversation about issues such as a basic income. I see a debate happening about that. And increasingly what we see is people who 10 years ago would say that's crazy. Now they're saying, well, maybe we should have a debate. And I have misgivings about a universal basic income. But I think it's something that we may have to consider because as technology continues to deliver new solutions for automation, well, the need for labor, especially in certain occupations, becomes less. And that is not just an economic problem. It's a social and a political problem.
Mauro, you quote Elon Musk as saying, excessive automation at Tesla was a mistake and humans are underrated. Do you see a reckoning here in the corporate world over the next 10 years, an awakening, if you will?
Well, I think two things must happen within the corporate world. One is that companies start thinking that AI, artificial intelligence, robotics, yes, it can be a substitute for the human brain, but perhaps the best of all worlds is one in which we can expand the human capacity to think and to analyze with the use of robotics and artificial intelligence. So in other words, to look for ways in which the two are complements as opposed to substitutes for each other.
Define the singularity.
So the singularity is this moment when artificial intelligence takes over and the machines essentially are so good that human intelligence is no longer needed. That's a specter. That's a dystopia that some thinkers, including, by the way, major physicists such as Stephen Hawking, mm-hmm, right, mm-hmm. many years ago said that could happen and that would be the end of things as we know them. I don't think, well, definitely that's not going to happen by the year 2030, okay? But then the other issue, that I think is extremely important when it comes to all of these discussions is that I think companies also need to be responsible for the consequences. And as you know, there are these proposals that perhaps we should tax the robots. So the robots should pay taxes just as you and I do, right? And then with that revenue, the same way that we tax gasoline because there are consequences and because we need to repair roads, well, we tax the robots. And then with that revenue, we deal with the consequences, especially for people who are displaced.
Let's look at the tech industry from a global perspective for just a moment. There's Silicon Valley, of course, but the Silicon Savannah resides in Africa. Tell us about the Silicon Savannah and about Africa as an emerging player in the tech industry.
Yes, yeah, so Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and some countries within it, especially Ghana, Kenya, Uganda, they've been ahead of us in terms of the implementation of certain technologies. So 10 years ago, they bet big on mobile payments. And now they are pretty much a cashless society. I mean, we're still, you know, using personal checks and greenbacks and so on and so forth. And then the other really amazing thing that has happened in Africa over the last 10 years or so is telemedicine. So on average in Africa, people live about 2 hours away from a doctor by bus, 2 hours away on average. I mean, remember, most population in Africa is still rural, right? And the roads are not very good. Well, at long last here in the United States, we've learned that telemedicine has a role to play. So over the last few months, as you know, many hospitals, many healthcare centers have been closed, but I hear from many hospital systems, including our own, the system at the University of Pennsylvania, the healthcare system, that they're conducting hundreds of thousands of telemedicine sessions since the beginning of the pandemic. So in other words, Africa has shown us the future, out of necessity, of course, right? They had to implement these systems. Now we are actually seeing the light and implementing some of those things that Africa has pioneered.
Mauro, going into the break, just if you could define the blockchain. You mentioned it early in the conversation. What is it and exactly how it's evolving to underpin the validity of what happens in the digital world? We've got about 30 seconds.
It's a mysterious thing. So it's just a registry. And you can think about it as a wall, right, with a lot of bricks. And in every brick, you make an inscription of something that has happened. Maybe you purchased something, or I purchased something, or I sold something. And then that inscription of the brick remains forever, and everybody can see all of those inscriptions on that wall, massive wall with millions of billions of bricks.
All right. More on the blockchain and a few other topics. Mauro Guillen is author of the new book, 2030, How Today's Biggest Trends Will Collide and Reshape the Future of Everything. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moskowitz, and you're listening to Radio Times. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. We are speaking with Mauro Guillen, professor of international management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and author of the new book, 2030, How Today's Biggest Trends Will Collide and Reshape the Future of Everything. So we are talking about the future 10 years down the road in the United States and across the world. We are taking your calls and comments, 888-477-9499. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send along an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. And we're going to get to some of your questions in just a moment. But Mauro, I just wanted to kind of, you know, finish talking about blockchain and, you know, get into cryptocurrencies for just a moment. So blockchain is it's a digital registry that has enabled the existence of cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin. So with cryptocurrencies, where are we with this in 2030? There are strong believers in their revolutionary potential. There are detractors who believe the fundamental value of cryptocurrency is maybe less than zero. Mm-hmm. Where are we with cryptocurrency, and where are we with plain old cash?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Look, I think we're definitely moving towards electronic cash. However, the question is whether governments will continue to control electronic cash or whether we're going to see these cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin win the game. And I am skeptical about cryptocurrencies actually winning the game because governments and central banks, the Federal Reserve in the United States, are very reluctant to give up the power and the leverage that having their own currency, right, the one that we call the dollar, be the one that everyone uses. So I'm skeptical about the future of cryptocurrencies unless we add other features to them. For example, we include incentives in them, built into them, to, for example, save the planet, save endangered species, address climate change. So, in other words, invite people to do the right thing. And that, I think, can be accomplished with digital tokens. In other words, with cryptocurrencies that are not just about money, but they're also about behavior and, you know, the kinds of things that we could do to make the world a better world.
Will banks and banking jobs survive technological innovation?
I have my doubts as well. You see, when I make presentations about the book, and frequently I have bankers in the audience, I always tell them, out of the next three things, I think only one is going to survive. And I tell them it's banks, banking, and bankers. And most of the time they tell me banking is what's going to survive. So not even the bankers believe that they're going to survive, or that the banks. I think there's going to be a big revolution in financial services because fintech, you know, all of these applications of technology to financial services are slowly but surely taking business away from the banks. And the banks are, as you know, trading, you know, at very low prices in the stock market. I don't think they have a future as they are currently structured. And by the way, this is happening everywhere in the world. It's not just an American phenomenon.
We have a question from Luann, who asks, in cities in the West and Southwest, we're seeing population growth in deserts, and that is drying up limited water sources. What policies can we push for to develop more sustainably?
Well, I think we can introduce policies, you know, or we can have guidelines that essentially ensure that we're not going to develop new housing in areas where, you know, in 10 years down the road or 15 years down the road, it's going to be very difficult to sustain life, right, or to bring the water. Yeah. But having said that, I think we also need to educate consumers, in this case, home buyers or home renters, that they shouldn't be fooled by, you know, some of these promises. Obviously, maybe that type of housing is very cheap because the land in those parts of the country is cheap. But they should, you know, think twice about the implications, right, long term.
Let's get back to the older population. Chapter 2 of your book is titled Gray is the New Black. And in it, you say the fastest growing market segment in the world is not millennials, which I thought was a little surprising. It's people over 60. Has advertising caught on to this yet, Mauro?
No, not yet. So today, about 12,000 Americans are celebrating their 60th birthday. And globally is more, slightly more than 200,000 people today, just today. So as you said, by the year 2030, the purchasing power of that group of people above the age of 60 will make them the largest segment of consumers in the market here in the United States and in most other countries in the world. And brands, companies, I don't think have adjusted to this new reality. If you go to a major clothing store here in the United States, you'll see that they don't carry clothes for people in their 70s or their 80s. And by the way, the reason is because they feel that would tarnish their brand image. This is very well documented in marketing research.
Youth
that
sells.
Will have to change. That will have to change.
I guess there'll be a large market for robotics. We touched on immigration and elder care earlier in the show, Mauro. I'm not quite sure we finished our conversation about the role robotics will play in elder care, what that looks like. You've said that you found that Japan is leading the world in robotics for seniors. So what might we see in 2030 in terms of elder care with robotics?
So I think we're going to see that people who prefer to stay at home, even though they are physically declining and there's a number of tasks, domestic tasks they can no longer perform, they will be interested in purchasing a robot that helps them do certain things like lift the shopping bag from the floor to the countertop in the kitchen, these sorts of things. And not only that, we're also going to see the rise in comfort robots. So pets that are actually robots, the most famous one right now is Paru, is a Japanese robotic seal. And you see every nursing home in the Netherlands and in Denmark has one of these robots. And
people
in the 70s, yeah, but people in the 70s and the 80s that interact with these robots, people who have, for example, they suffer from dementia, they're reporting huge improvements in their quality of life. So it's not just robotics to help us, you know, perform certain physical tasks. It's also robotics to make us feel better, right?
Yeah.
And that is the brave new future around the corner expecting us.
And at the same time, what will the impact of millennials be, today's millennials in 2030? What role will they play?
They will play a very important role because they will be in their 40s and their 50s. And shortly thereafter, by the way, the oldest millennials will start maybe going into retirement. You see, I feel bad for millennials. This is the second big crisis to hit them during their adult lives. And I think we should give them a break. We've been criticizing their lifestyle, their consumption, their attitudes, their values for the last 10, 15 years. But this is the second crisis they're going through. And this is going to be devastating, I think, for that generation of people. But again,
Will they rise to the occasion, do you
oh, I
think?
think they will. I think they will. And you see, when we talk about millennials, there's many different kinds of millennials out there. Some of them are highly educated and they have all of these behaviors that we commonly associate with that demographic. But there's also millennials who didn't finish high school and who are having trouble in this labor market and who are being affected by technological change big time, right? So I think we need to be a little bit more detail-oriented in terms of both our praise and our criticism of millennials. But again, I think it's going to be really tough for them because going through two crises within 10 years, essentially 12 years, that is bad. I mean, no other generation in American history over the last 100 years has gone through two consecutive crises, right? Other than the greatest generation, first the Great Depression and then World War II.
You started your research for this book before the pandemic hit, before anybody imagined the pandemic would hit. How does the coronavirus change the course of trends that were underway as you were doing your research?
Yeah, so you see, pandemics come in two kinds. So there are pandemics in history that have changed history, that have essentially sent the world in a totally different direction. And there are pandemics like the current one, which I think for the most part represents an acceleration of pre-existing trends. So we were talking about the decline in fertility. Well, the pandemic accelerates that decline. There's been discussions about remote work and whether we're going to continue working from the home. Well, that was going on before the pandemic. The rise of emerging markets, you name it, right? There's a couple of trends, though, that the pandemic partially slows down, which I think one of them is, of course, the growth of cities, right? I mean, a lot of people are revisiting those decisions. But for the most part, we are in the midst of a pandemic that accelerates pre-existing trends. And so, in other words, Mary, to tell you the truth, my only regret about this book, and I do reflect this in the postscript, is that instead of maybe calling the book 2030, I should have called it 2028, because the future is arriving earlier, right? I mean, this is what I think people need to realize, that that future is arriving earlier as a result of this pandemic. So it's even more urgent to prepare for it.
Well, let's talk about a concerning number that's happening in the near future. The Congressional Budget Office, Mauro, is warning that the federal budget deficit will stand at $3.3 trillion at the end of this month. And next year, the federal debt will likely exceed the size of the American economy for the first time since 1946, which was the year after World War II ended. If you would disagree, we have to get families and businesses through the pandemic. When this is over, what are the economic consequences, though, of this enormous debt? And what do we do now to prepare for it?
Yeah, so I think there are two distinct consequences when it comes to economics here. One is the one that you're mentioning, the debt. And remember, that's important in terms of how big it is relative to the size of the economy. If we can get the economy growing again, then that percentage that our national debt represents will go down just because we're growing the economy. But we need to keep an eye on it. There's no question about it. And by the way, the Federal Reserve a couple of weeks ago said that they're changing their policies slightly to focus more on unemployment rather than inflation, right? And remember, if we allow for slightly higher inflation, that also reduces over time the amount of debt, right? Just that, just that. But the other big thing about Social Security that, given the changes in fertility as a result of the pandemic, also the Social Security, system
Hang on
will be
one second,
underwater.
Mauro. You know what? I just we had a little bit of a breakup here in our transmission. Could you just repeat that last sentence? I couldn't understand it.
Yes. The last sentence is that, in addition to the debt, we also need to keep an eye on the Social Security system and how solid it is. And the projection is that by the year 2029, so just one year before 2030, the financial ratio for Social Security will dip below 100%. And that's also something that is being accelerated by the pandemic because we're having fewer babies and therefore or postponing them. And therefore, the population balance in terms of how many people are working, how many people are collecting pensions, it's also worsening much faster than we thought.
Let's touch on health for just a moment. According to your research, more people suffered from hunger globally than obesity just 3 years ago. But by 2030, the population of obese people will be far greater than those who are consistently hungry. How did you come to this conclusion?
So this is the based on the long-term trends by the WHO, the World Health Organization. And the reason for this, by the way, is that we have too much bad food going around in the world. So it's processed foods, right? And then also our lifestyle is becoming so much more sedentary, right? We don't exercise as much. People are moving from physical jobs to office jobs and so on and so forth. So the trend is very clear. The pandemic seems to be slowing it down a little bit in a bad way, which is that actually hunger, as you know, is increasing, right, in some parts of the world as a result of this economic crisis. But still, I would continue to predict that by the year 2030, the bigger problem in the world is going to be obesity as opposed to hunger. And I think this is an eye-opener, right? It's like, how do we end up there?
Is this a consequence or is this a part of the growth of the middle class across the world?
Of course, because the middle class, has a lifestyle. They want cars. They want bigger homes with air conditioning. But they also want more beef, and they want more, and they eat more processed foods. They eat more snacks, and they have more of those beverages that are bad for our health. And so, in other words, yes, we also need to educate the middle class. And by the way, the numbers coming out of China, where, as you know, the middle class is growing really, really quickly, are stunning about the growth of obesity, even in China that, just two generations ago, the overwhelming problem was hunger.
Well, so overall, across the world, according to your figures, middle class consumption will grow by about 55% by 2030. What does this mean for the world's resources? What do we need to start thinking about now?
Yeah, what we need to start thinking about now is how much we waste. Here in the United States, but the proportion is similar globally, we waste about a third of the food that reaches the consumer. We just let it go bad, or we waste it, we don't finish what's on our plate. There's so much waste going around. We buy way too many clothes. I mean, we could do without at least 50% of the clothes that we buy every year, right? Some of those pieces of clothing, we wear them once or twice, and then we just forget about them. They're sitting in our closet for years. So there's so much waste. And so we need to educate this new middle class in those parts of the world where it's growing so fast, that being middle class is also being conscious and aware of the environmental consequences. Unfortunately, I think we've lost that battle here in the United States a long time ago. But I'm hopeful that maybe we can change the minds of those emerging middle classes in Asia, in Africa, in the Middle East.
One more quick pandemic-related question for you, Mauro, before we wrap up. Will the virtual office, the ability to work from home, completely reshape how companies operate going forward? What do you see happening by 2030?
I see a hybrid model emerging. So what I hear from both companies and employees now through surveys is that they like working from home, but working only from the home is too much. And companies complain that coordination is starting to suffer. So I think we're moving in a direction in which people will work from home a couple of days a week and then go to the office maybe 3 days a week. So a hybrid model. And of course, technology, these platforms that we're using now to interact remotely will get better. Maybe virtual reality will make it feel as if we were at the office. So I think we're moving into a hybrid model with the use of technology and providing people and companies with a better way of getting things done.
Got about 15 seconds left. Are you optimistic about the future, Mauro?
I am very optimistic, but we need to address those challenges right now.
Mauro Guillen, a pleasure. Fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Mary.
Mauro Guillen is professor at the Wharton School and author of 2030, How Today's Biggest Trends Will Collide and Reshape the Future of Everything. Don't forget to join us on social media at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for joining us. Be well.